readers, welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles, and there's a story to this week's show. In fact, our show today is all about stories, storytelling, monologues, and tales. In a few moments, I'll be speaking with Kenneth Littlehawk, a Native American storyteller, keynote speaker, and actor who has performed for more than 3 million people. But for now, let's get this story straight. It's time to settle back, relax, and be ready to be entertained.
Traditional advertising can be expensive and wasteful. But lately, you've been hearing a lot about social media and viral marketing. But let's be honest, it's confusing. That's why you need Magic Buzz, a new marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media, like Facebook, Twitter, together with the viral reach power of YouTube, to create the socio-viral effect. The Magic Buzz team makes sure our clients are well-represented online. We recently took word-of-mouth advertising to the number one position as most productive medium for a major cell phone company. That's right. Magic Buzz produced more sales than an expensive TV campaign at a fraction of the cost. Put the power of socio-viral marketing to work for you. Visit us at magicbuzz.com. M-A-G-I-C-B-U-Z.com. If you have any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz, we're there when you can't be.
For Everyone, Short Stories, the Vintage Collection, features unabridged selections from literary giants like F. Scott Fitzgerald, Thomas Hardy, Kate Chopin, James Thurber, P.G. Wodehouse, and many more. The tales are brilliantly read by great talents like Derek Jacobi, Hugh Laurie, and Barbara Lee Hunt. Now, I know short stories are not usually what I'd reach for, but wow, listen in and discover how magical they can be.
At his feet, a little girl, dressed in blue, a little hood and a long cape, the uniform of the orphanage, was reading the life of St. Irenaeus out of a book bigger than herself. This tale of miracles had performed a miracle upon the whole house. All slept. The old man in his armchair, the flies on the ceiling, the canaries in their cage over there on the windowsill. The big clock snored. Tick-tock, tick-tock. Nothing remained awake in all the room except a broad ray of sunlight which shone between the closed shutters, a straight white beam full of living sparks and microscopic waltzes. Amidst this general slumber, the child gravely went on with her reading. Straightway, two lions fell upon him and devoured him. It was at this point that I entered. The results were dramatic. If the lions of St. Irenaeus themselves had leapt into the room, they could not have caused more astonishment. The little girl shrieked, the big book dropped, the canaries and flies awoke, the clock struck, the old man jumped up, shaking with fright, and I myself, a little uneasy, stopped short on the threshold, where I called out very loudly, "Good day, good people, I am Maurice's friend." Oh! If you only could have seen the poor old man then, if you could have seen him come to me with wide open arms, embrace me, shake my hands, run bewildered round the room, exclaiming, "Oh, good gracious me! Oh, good gracious me!" His face had gone quite red, and every wrinkle in it was laughing. He kept stammering, Oh, monsieur! Then he went to the back of the room and called, "Mamette!" The sound of a door opening and a mouse-like pattering in the passage. It was Mamette, a dear little old woman in a beribboned bonnet and a Carmelite gown, and holding in her hand an embroidered handkerchief to do me honour, as was the fashion long ago. It touched me greatly to see how much they resembled each other. With some ribbons and bows, his name could also have been Mamette. But the real Mamette must have shed many tears in her life, because she had even more wrinkles than he. Like him, too, she was attended by a child from the orphanage, a little guardian in a blue cape who never left her. And to see those two old people watched over by these orphan children was more moving than anything I could ever have imagined. As she came in, Mamette had started to make me a low curtsy, but it was quickly cut short as soon as the old man said, "This is Maurice's friend." She trembles, weeps, loses her handkerchief, flushes an even deeper red than he. "Quick, quick, a chair," says the old woman to her little girl. "Open the shutters," cries the old man to his. And taking me each by a hand, they lead me at a trot to the now wide-open window in order to get a better look at me. Then the armchairs are pushed forward. I sit down between them on a stool, the little girls in blue behind us, and the interrogation begins. "How is he? What is he doing? Why doesn't he come? Is he happy?" And so on and so on, like that, for hours. I did my best to answer all their questions, giving what details I knew about my friend, shamelessly inventing those I did not know, taking special care not to confess I had ever noticed if his windows shut tight or even the colour of his wallpaper. His wallpaper, it's blue, madame, light blue with a garland design. "Really?" exclaimed the old lady with great emotion, and added, turning to her husband, "He's such a good boy." "Indeed he is, a fine lad," the old man replied enthusiastically. And all the time I was speaking, they kept nodding their heads at each other, giving little laughs and winking in a knowing way at each other. But sometimes the old man would lean towards me and say, "Speak louder, she doesn't hear too well." Then she, in her turn, "A little louder, I beg you, his hearing is not too good." So I would raise my voice, and both of them would thank me with a smile. And they would lean forward as if seeking within my eyes some image of their Maurice. It was then that I found myself most deeply moved, for in those tired smiles of theirs I seemed myself to see the image of my friend, elusive, vague, dim, as though he were smiling at me himself from far away through a deep mist. Suddenly the old man sits up in his chair. "Mehmet, I've just thought. Perhaps he's not had any lunch."
The Fairy Tales of Oscar Wilde, recorded here in aid of the Royal Theatrical Fund, reveal deep understanding of the tragedy of the human condition, as well as its transcendence through generosity, self-sacrifice, beauty, faith, and love. The readers include Judy Dench, Jeremy Irons, and Derek Jacobi, and they bring life to characters and situations that sometimes bring a smile and sometimes bring tears.
"She said that you would dance with me if I brought her red roses," cried the young student. "But in all my garden there is no red rose." From her nest in the home oak tree, the nightingale heard him, and she looked out through the leaves and wondered. "No red rose in all my garden," he cried, and his beautiful eyes filled with tears. "Ah! On what little things does happiness depend? I have read all that the wise men have written, and all the secrets of philosophy are mine, yet for want of a red rose is my life made wretched." "Here at last is a true lover," said the nightingale. "Night after night have I sung of him, though I knew him not. Night after night have I told his story to the stars, and now I see him. His hair is dark, and his lips are red as the rose of his desire, but passion has made his face like pale ivory, and sorrow has set her seal upon his brow." "The prince gives a ball tomorrow night," murmured the young student, "and my love will be there. If I bring her a red rose, I shall hold her in my arms, and she will lean her head upon my shoulder, and her hand will be clasped in mine. But there is no red rose in my garden, and she will pass me by, and my heart will break." "Here indeed is the true lover," said the nightingale. "What I sing of, he suffers. What is joy to me, to him is pain. Surely love is a wonderful thing. It is more precious than emeralds, and dearer than fine opals. Pearls and pomegranates cannot buy it, nor can it be weighed out in the balance for gold. The musicians will sit in their gallery and play," said the young student. "She will dance so lightly that her feet will not touch the floor. But with me she will not dance, for I have no red rose to give her." And he flung himself down on the grass and wept. "Why is he weeping?" asked the little green lizard as he ran past him with his tail in the air. "Why, indeed," said a butterfly, who was fluttering about after a sunbeam. "Why, indeed," whispered a daisy to his neighbour in a soft, low voice. "He is weeping for a red rose," said the nightingale. "For a red rose," they cried. "How very ridiculous." And the little lizard, who was something of a cynic, laughed outright.
The James Thurber audio collection, Fables and Selected Stories, is a new performance by, of all people, Keith Olbermann. Olbermann explains that when his dad was in the hospital, he would read him the stories of James Thurber. One night, his dad said, "You really should do that on your show." And Keith said, "Dad, it's TV newscast. I'd love to, but how could it possibly fit?" But his father persisted, and, well, the rest is story history. Very entertaining history, as you're about to hear.
Ever since I saw the great William Wyndham adapt his one-man show about James Thurber on PBS in the 70s, the idea of reading the works of this most versatile of American humorists has fascinated me. In college, I can recall reading A Box to Hide In to a public speaking class that included a couple of friends from our radio station who shared my professional aspirations. "Forget doing the sports or the news," one of them said. "This is what you should be doing for a living." I replied, "Gladly." But it was not for another 31 years that it became even the faintest of possibilities. My father was in the hospital, and every night when I visited him, I read aloud to him, James Thurber. And one night he said, "You really should do that on your show." And I said, "Dad, it's a television newscast. I'd love to. But how could it possibly fit?" And he said, "How often have I ever suggested anything for your shows?" And I remembered that he never had. But I also reminded him that there were things like copyrights and bills, to which he said, "Try it. You'll never know." A few weeks later, Dad fell into a deep sleep from which he would only briefly awake. A dear friend of mine told me to keep reading to him, that he had once been in a coma, and he could hear every word that was said. And the worst part was, it was so boring. When I recounted this on the air, I thought I'd read one of the Thurber fables that had so delighted my dad, The Peace-Like Mongoose, the first Thurber story I ever read aloud as part of my living. The next day came an email from the James Thurber Literary Estate. To my joy and surprise, it was not a bill. It was a note from his agents, telling of how they and Thurber's daughter Rosemary were all fans and all surprised and all delighted to suddenly hear the fable on their newscast. Moreover, that fable, of all of James Thurber's writings, was a story unto itself. It was to be included in a collection for high school students, provided that the editors could cut out a few words about which they had concerns. Rosie Thurber naturally wanted to keep her dad in print and was trying to find a way to say yes to those editors. Then, out of the blue, she heard me read the story on national television with no edits, and she realized The Peace-Like Mongoose had to be printed as is or not at all. Incredibly, the publishers then called to say they had rethought their position and they wanted to print The Peace-Like Mongoose as it was. As my dad had said, try it. You never know. I began to read James Thurber once a week on television and continued to do so whenever and wherever I can. I'm happy to say this has sparked a mini revival, which I hope erupts into a full-scale, newfound appreciation for a man whose writings are nearly perfect. He did not intend them to be read aloud, but they are ideally suited for that task. Clean, economical, vivid, full of crashes and thuds and silences as well. And for that matter, they also make wonderful tributes to memories. Memories of my dad and of Rosemary Thurber's dad. I hope you enjoy what follows. It is my honor to read James Thurber to you.
Okay, I'm going to take a small detour, but for a great reason. We've just heard from a master storyteller, so I thought you'd enjoy a classic from another great storyteller, Stephen King. In his On Writing, A Memoir of the Craft, King shares the story of a compelling trip through the mind, style, life, and work of one of America's most popular writers, Stephen King. It's an improbably fascinating, relentlessly compelling journey through his mind. Even if you haven't been a fan of King or read much of the genre, this is a work about the art of writing, the why of writing, and the inspiration for writing. Hearing this unique combination of anecdotes and insider's advice told in King's own charmingly nasal voice makes an already insightful narrative even more personal and powerful. If you want to learn how to tell a tale in print, you might want to pick this one up. Even if you have no interest in writing, King's anecdotes and instructions into the art and process will probably make you a better, more informed reader.
I didn't want to write a book, even a short one like this, that would leave me feeling like either a literary gas bag or a transcendental. There are enough of those books and those writers on the market already, thanks. But Amy was right. Nobody ever asks about the language. They ask the DeLillos and the Updikes and the Styrons, but they don't ask popular novelists. Yet many of us proles also care about the language in our humble way and care passionately about the art and craft of telling stories on paper. What follows is an attempt to put down, briefly and simply, how I came to the craft, what I know about it now, and how it's done. It's about the day job. It's about the language. This book is dedicated to Amy Tan, who told me in a very simple and direct way that it was okay to write it. Second foreword. This is a short book because most books about writing are filled with fiction writers, present company included, don't understand very much about what they do, not why it works when it's good, not why it doesn't when it's bad. I figured the shorter the book, the less the One notable exception to the rule is The Elements of Style by William Strunk Jr. and E.B. White. There is little or no detectable in that book. Of course, it's short. At 85 pages, it's much shorter than this one. I'll tell you right now that every aspiring writer should read The Elements of Style. Rule 17 in the chapter titled Principles of Composition is omit needless words. I will try to do that here. Third foreword. One rule of the road not directly stated elsewhere in this book. The editor is always right. The corollary is that no writer will take all of his or her editor's advice, for all have sinned and fallen short of editorial perfection. Put another way, to write is human, to edit is divine. Chuck Verrill edited this book, as he has so many of my novels. As usual, Chuck, you were divine. C.V. I was stunned by Mary Carr's memoir, The Liar's Club, not just by its ferocity, its beauty, and by her delightful grasp of the vernacular, but by its totality. She is a woman who remembers everything about her early years. I'm not that way. I lived an odd, herky-jerky childhood, raised by a single parent who moved around a lot in my earliest years and who, I am not completely sure of this, may have farmed my brother and me out to one of her sisters for a while because she was economically or emotionally unable to cope with us for a time. Perhaps she was only chasing our father, who piled up all sorts of bills and then did a run-out when I was 2 and my brother David was 4. If so, she never succeeded in finding him. My mom, Nellie Ruth Pillsbury King, was one of America's early liberated women, but not by choice. Mary Carr presents her childhood in an almost unbroken panorama. Mine is a fogged-out landscape from which occasional memories appear like isolated trees. the kind that look as if they might like to grab and eat you. What follows are some of those memories, plus assorted snapshots from the somewhat more coherent days of my adolescence and young manhood. This is not an autobiography. It is, rather, a kind of curriculum vitae, my attempt to show how one writer was formed. Not how one writer was made. I don't believe writers can be made, either by circumstances or by self-will, although I did believe those things once. The equipment comes with the original package, yet it is by no means unusual equipment. I believe large numbers of people have at least some talent as writers and storytellers, and that those talents can be strengthened and sharpened. If I didn't believe that, writing a book like this would be a waste of time. This is how it was for me, that's all. A disjointed growth process in which ambition, desire, luck, and a little talent all played a part.
Kenneth Little Hawk is a Native American storyteller, keynote speaker, recording artist, and actor. He is a descendant of the Mi'kmaq and Mohawk peoples. His voice and authentic flute music can be heard in the award-winning PBS films The West and Lewis and Clark, produced by Ken Burns. He has performed at the Kennedy Center, Lincoln Center, and at the White House. Little Hawk has been nominated twice for Best Storyteller of the Year by the Native American Music Awards. He has made a big impact in the corporate world, presenting his stories and bringing his lessons to audiences at PepsiCo, AT&T, Verizon, Sony, as well as government organizations like the Federal Executive Board and the U.S. Army. Little Hawk shares Native American culture, music, storytelling, and dance, and his people's belief that all humans need to honor, cherish, and preserve the earth, and must work together to mend the global hoop that encompasses all life. We're going to discuss his new book, Learning Little Hawk's Way of Storytelling, written with his wife, Beverly Miller, and told to Frank Domenico Cipriani. For more information about Kenneth Little Hawk, go to the website www.kennethlittlehawk.com. You'll find his appearance schedule as well as how to order the book, which is published by Findhorn Press. Welcome, Little Hawk. It's such a pleasure to have you with us today.
Thank you.
I want to ask you, you are of Mi'kmaq, Mohawk, and Shinnecock heritage, but
yes.
Where exactly did you grow up?
I grew up in New Jersey.
New Jersey. All right. And are there many of your people still in the Northeast?
Oh, yes. Somewhere in the vicinity of 14,000.
Ah, all right. So when you were small, who were your storytellers?
My grandmother and grandfather.
And when they told the stories, was it in a group situation or was it one-on-one and...
Well, sometimes it was in a group situation, and sometimes it was one-on-one. If more than one child or one person was around, then the stories were told in the evening when everyone was at home. And sometimes during the day, especially when I was very young, before I went to school, I was told stories just one-on-one.
And did your grandparents kind of mark you as a storyteller? Did they see your talent, or how did that come about?
The way it came about was that my grandmother and grandfather would teach me things at a very young age, and they found that doing it with storytelling was a way that could be easily remembered by me. And they would do it in an entertaining way, and they would be relating such values as unselfishness, integrity, honesty, humility, and so much more. And in the oral tradition of teaching that way, it was very easy for me to remember those things even at a young age. I can refer it to Walt Disney and Bambi and Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. That, as a child, we remember for the rest of our lives, and in each of those stories that Disney told, the underlying lesson for all of us was to to help each other.
In the book, you talk a lot about storytelling. As you just said, it's teaching a lesson, communicating a moral. I'm wondering, are the tales evolving over the years? Are they influenced by current events?
Well, you have your traditional stories. Of course, those more or less stay the same. Those are the ones that were handed down from the ancestors to the elders and the great-grandparents to the grandparents to the parents. And they stay basically the same. The contemporary stories will have the same messages, but they'll have to do with things of today, making it much easier for the people that are familiar with the ways of today to remember. Today we drive to places where we want to go. Many years ago, the automobile wasn't around, so we either walked, ran, took a canoe, or we rode horses. So the stories change, but the traditional stories stay the same.
Okay. I know that you do, you address corporate audiences, and what lessons and what teachings do you offer them, and how are they received?
Well, they're received very well, let's see, one of the stories that I tell is that the elder asked the question, how can we determine the hour of dawn when night ends and day begins? Someone answered, when from a distance you can distinguish a coyote from a wolf. Another called out, saying, when there's enough light to distinguish a pine tree from a cedar tree. The elder said no to both. It is when you look into the face of a human being and have enough light inside you to recognize him or her as brother and sister. Up until then, it is night, and darkness is still with us.
Could you possibly share one of the stories from your book with our listeners?
One day the birds decided they were going to have a contest. So they got together in a large opening in the forest, and all of the birds from all over came to this point. And the contest was which bird could fly closest to the Great Spirit. Could fly the highest. All of the birds lined up. One by one, they took off and they flew. They went up as high as they could, and many of them got so tired that they turned around and came back. Well, it came down to the last bird, and the last bird was the eagle. And the eagle flapped his wings, soared high into the sky, higher and higher and higher, until he was just a little dot way up in the sky. Knowing that he had outflown all the other birds, he turned to come back down to earth. And as he turned to come back down to earth, a little bird that was hiding in the wing between the feathers took off and flew up higher. Well, they both got back to the clearing, and when they did, the old elder birds that were the judges said, we saw what happened up there in the sky. And the little bird said, yes, yes, the contest was who can fly the highest. I flew the highest. I am the winner of the contest. Me, I am the winner of the contest. And the elders said, let us talk about this. So the elders went into the lodge, and they stayed in there for about a few minutes and came out, and each one had agreed that the winner of the contest was the eagle. I flew the highest, said the little bird. I did. Me, I flew the highest. The elder spoke, saying, you want to take credit for the work and the energy that the eagle put into flying as high as he did when you were resting in the feathers of his wing? No, no, that's deceptive. That's cheating and lying. You cannot be trusted. lost you. No, you did not win. The eagle was the winner. The eagle flew the highest, not you. All of the other birds that were there said, yay, yay, yay. The eagle did the work. The eagle gets the credit, not the little bird. The little bird began to walk away, saying, oh, I did fly the highest, but I only flew the highest after I took advantage of the eagle. I will not do that again. And then all of the birds that heard the little bird say this, they then cheered the little bird. Yay, yay, yay for the little bird. Off he went into the woods to think about how he behaved and how he will behave in the future. To me one day, and grandfather said, you know birds can talk, eh? I said, no, grandfather, I didn't know birds could talk. Oh, yes, birds talk, and we have to listen to them. I said, grandfather, will you show me, will you take me to see the birds talk? Oh, I'm gonna take you. You come with me. We go outside. So we went outside, sat under a tree, and grandfather told me to be sure and listen very closely, not only with my ears, but with my heart, to the messages that the birds will send to us when they sing. So I listened. And in a tree, right in front of us, there was a red and black bird, and it sang its song like this. Another bird that was yellow and white, and it had a song, and it sounded like this. Both birds started singing their own songs at the same time, and it sounded said, what did you learn from the messages that the birds were giving you? And I said, grandfather, the red and black bird had a pretty song all of its own. And the yellow and white bird, it had a pretty song too, all of its own. And when they put both of their songs together, it sounded twice as pretty. Grandfather said, what else did it tell you? He said, it told me, grandfather, that you don't have to be the same kind of bird to have a pretty song. One bird can have a pretty song, and the other bird can have a pretty song. And when they put them together, it sounds twice as pretty. So you don't have to be the same in order to put something pretty together that will work for the both of you and for those that listen. Grandfather said, it's a good thing you still got Grandpa, because today people don't listen to the environment anymore. And the environment was our first teachers.
Little Hawk, thank you so much for sharing. Learning Little Hawk's Way of Storytelling is available from your website. Thank you so much for joining us today. It was really a very special, special interview. Thank you so much.
My wife and I thank you for having us on your show, and we do hope that all of your listeners not only continue to listen to you, but multiply. Thank you again.
Thank you. Few entertainers can spin a tale as engagingly as David Sedaris. We've previewed his Squirrel Seeks Chipmunk last year. You can listen to a preview of that title at my website, bookreportradio.com. Just go to archived shows for October 30th. But today, we're going to get a sampling of When You Are Engulfed in Flames, a collection of Sedaris' essays at once uproariously funny and profoundly moving. Sedaris uses life's most bizarre moments to reach new heights in understanding love and fear, family and strangers. Some examples. He pushes the boundaries of laziness when, finding the water shut off in his house in Normandy, he looks to the water in a vase of fresh-cut flowers to fill the coffee machine. He describes in great detail the awkwardness of having a lozenge fall from your mouth into the lap of a sleeping fellow passenger on a plane. I could go on, but instead, let's listen to a bit of Sedaris' sixth essay collection, performed by the author.
Well, that's sort of chauvinistic of you, don't you think? Ma Hamrick said. She'd come to Paris for Christmas, as had Lisa and her husband Bob. The gifts had all been opened, and she was collecting the used wrapping paper and ironing it flat with her hands. It was just a guinea worm. People got 'em all the time. She looked toward the kitchen where Hugh was doing something to a goose. Honey, where do you want me to put this paper? Burn it, Hugh said. Oh, but it's so pretty. Are you sure you don't want to use it again? Burn it, he repeated. What's this about a worm? Lisa asked. She was lying on the sofa with a blanket over her, still groggy from her nap. Joan here had a worm living inside her leg, I said. And Ma Hamrick threw a sheet of wrapping paper into the fire, saying, Oh, I wouldn't call that living. But it was inside of you, Lisa said, and I could see her wheels turning. Have I used the toilet after this woman? Have I ever touched her coffee cup or eaten off her plate? How soon can I get tested? Are the hospitals open on Christmas Day, or will I have to wait until tomorrow? It was a long time ago, Joan said. Like, how long? Lisa asked. I don't know, 1968, maybe. My sister nodded, the way someone does when she's doing math in her head. Right, she said, and I regretted having brought it up. She was no longer looking at Ma Hamrick, but through her, seeing what an X-ray machine might. The stark puzzle of bones, and teeming within it, the thousands of worms who did not leave home in 1968. I used to see the same thing, but after 15 years or so, I got over it. And now I just see Ma Hamrick. Ma Hamrick ironing. Ma Hamrick doing the dishes. Ma Hamrick taking out the trash. She wants to be a good house guest and is always looking for something to do. Can I maybe, she asks, and before she's finished, I answer yes, by all means. Did you tell my mother to crawl on her hands and knees across the living room floor, Hugh asks. And I say, well, no, not exactly. I just suggested that if she was going to dust the baseboards, that might be the best way to do it. When Ma Hamrick's around, I don't lift a finger. All my chores go automatically to her, and I just sit in a rocker, raising my feet every now and then so she can pass the vacuum. It's incredibly relaxing, but it doesn't make me look very good, especially if she's doing something strenuous, carrying furniture to the basement, for instance. Which again was completely her idea. I just mentioned in passing that we rarely used that dresser, and that one of these days someone should take it downstairs. I didn't mean her exactly, though at age 76 she's a lot stronger than Hugh gives her credit for. Coming from Kentucky, she's used to a hard day's work. Chopping, toting, all those activities with a drop G. The way I figure it, these things are in her genes. It's only a problem when other people are around, and they see this slight, white-haired woman with sweat running down her forehead. Lisa and Bob, for instance, who were staying in Patsy's empty apartment. Every night they'd come over for dinner, and Ma Hamrick would hang up their coats before ironing the napkins and setting the table. Then she'd serve drinks and head into the kitchen to help Hugh.
You really lucked out, Lisa said, sighing, as Joan rushed to empty my ashtray. Her mother-in-law had recently moved into an assisted living development, the sort of place that's renounced the word seniors and refers to the residents as graying tigers. I love Bob's mom to death, but Hughes, my God, and to think that she was eaten by worms. Well, they didn't technically eat her, I said. Then what were they living on? Are you telling me they brought their own food? I guessed that she was right, but what do guinea worms eat? Certainly not fat, or they'd never have gone to Joan, who weighs 90 pounds tops and can still fit into a prom gown. Not muscle, or she'd never be able to take over my chores. Do they drink blood? Drill holes in bone and sop up the marrow? I meant to ask, but when Ma Hamrick returned to the living room, the topic immediately turned to cholesterol. Lisa saying, I don't mean to pry, Joan, but what is your level? It was one of those conversations I was destined to be left out of. Not only have I never been tested, I'm not sure what cholesterol actually is.
While we're speaking of monologus, I want to share the final work from one of my favorites, Spalding Gray. When I first saw his film Swimming to Cambodia back in 1987, I was hooked. If you haven't seen it, try to. It's captivating. I was also lucky enough to see him in two live performances. What an experience. The audience got totally enveloped in his performance. It's really amazing stuff. Life Interrupted, the unfinished monologue, was the piece Spalding was working on when he died in the winter of 2004. Famous for his often manic and always humorous monologues, Gray was, by the late 1990s, in a happy marriage living in Long Island. But his life became unhinged after a devastating car accident in Ireland in 2001. His skull was fractured and his hip was crushed, sending Gray into a deep and unremitting depression. The fact that Spalding had begun performing a new piece gave his friends and family reason to hope that he might be emerging from his despair. The monologue recounts the story of the accident and Gray's hospitalization in Ireland with gallows humor. Quote, the following day, I slipped into a depression. I didn't know whether to tell the Irish about it, whether they would acknowledge this depression. I mean, does a fish know it's swimming in water? It's indigenous to the rainy culture, unquote. The last time Gray performed his work in progress, Life Interrupted, was at PS 122. At that time, he also read a short story called The Anniversary, about the afternoon he spent at the carousel in Central Park on the 10th anniversary of the day he met his wife. Like the unfinished monologue, this piece is also much darker than Gray's earlier work. The third piece in this collection is a short, remarkably poignant letter Spalding wrote about the terrorist attack of September 11th, titled Dear New York City. Sam Shepard narrates this work.
He felt a great tenderness for New York and for the great variety and vitality of its residents. And his Dear New York City is an expression of that tenderness, a love letter to the city at its most wounded and vulnerable moment, to that, quote, island off the coast of America, where human nature was king and everyone exuded character and had big attitude, unquote. All Spalding had to do was walk out his front door, and odd people gravitated to him. Strange things happened, things that would not have happened to anyone else. And what his accounts of his childhood, including the stories in Sex and Death to Age 14, suggest is that he was somehow born that way. Born with a capacity to see and hear and experience a little more deeply and widely than most everyone else. Part of what made him such a magnet for the unusual, such a likely mark for the demented ravings of every sort of obsessive crank, extremist, and lunatic, was his absolute openness, his commitment to considering every possibility, to refrain from judging, from jumping to form the sorts of quick, facile, conventional opinions that most people, well, most reasonable people, might reasonably entertain. Spalding liked to think of himself as a Buddhist. Once, when I interviewed him for Tricycle, the Buddhist magazine, I imagined that anyone who actually knew anything about Buddhism would probably have quickly concluded that both of us were making it up as we went along. But that didn't make our conversation any less searching or heartfelt. I think that part of what Buddhism meant to Spalding involved a series of brief maxims having to do with consciousness and conduct. Axioms like first thought, best thought, no judgment, that sort of thing. And strangers opened up to him, told him things they would not normally have told a stranger because they intuited, and people have an unusual awareness, almost a sixth sense for this sort of thing, that he would listen and not judge them. He listened, he really listened, in a way that few people ever managed to do, and his reward was that people told him stories that he could recycle and make part of his own story, his art. That was partly why interviewing the audience was one of the works I love most, and perhaps the one I saw most often, because it was always different and always fascinating. Before each performance, Spalding would circulate among the people waiting to see the show, asking for volunteers to join him on stage and participate in what had to have been the most gentle, low-key, reflective, and odd interview process imaginable. He had an uncanny eye for choosing people who had something exceptional and even startling to report, and he could, correctly it seemed to me, discover the zeitgeist of an entire city or region of the country from the kinds of stories its citizens told and their willingness to tell them. Meanwhile, for the audience, the experience of watching people open up and express what was in their hearts and minds always felt a little like playing with one of those astonishing children's toys, those little sponges you put in water and watch as they swell into a flower or a tiny dinosaur. Spalding had an enormous hunger for and curiosity about experience of every sort. He was game. He would try anything to see what it felt like and how it worked. He seemed to lack the sort of self-consciousness that keeps most people from doing things they fear might prove embarrassing or compromise their dignity. There was almost no invitation that he would turn down, and if he did, he would be consumed with regret about what marvelous things would have happened had he only been braver and accepted. He always longed to be in at least two places at once, to live as many concurrent lives as possible, and swimming to Cambodia is partly about that desire. Even when his health, his life, was at stake, he remained open to the siren song of possibility. When he developed a problem with his vision, he experimented with therapies that most of us wouldn't even consider. And Grey's Anatomy records his unlikely and hilarious pilgrim's progress from Sweat Lodge to Charlatan to the marginally more trust-inspiring frontiers of traditional medicine. The running joke of nearly every monologue is the way in which everything that happens to him seems to reflect, in a humorous and slightly creepy way that cannot be explained even by the laws of chance, and refer to everything else that has been happening to him. Everything is a reminder of his deepest worries, fears, and obsessions. It's something that many of us have discovered. Experience seems to follow a pattern, and incidents clumped together in ways that intensify and confirm our often darkest premonitions and preoccupations. Fate and coincidence conspire to keep us in a funhouse lined with mirrors glittering with images drawn up from the deep well of our own psyche. Spalding found in life, as so many artists do, what he was looking for, what he needed for his work. It wasn't anything half so simple as life imitating art. It was far more mysterious, something more like art guiding life, making things happen according to the needs of art. When he'd finished Morning, Noon, and Night, his hymn to happiness and domestic contentment, to the joy he'd finally found in being with his Kathy, Marissa, Forrest, and Theo, he worried that he would no longer be able to write any more monologues. He was afraid that the elements he had needed, anxiety, conflict, doubt, trouble for his work, were no longer present in his life. As he says in Life Interrupted, "My life is without crisis, and usually they're based on crisis. Things are going smoothly." When he performed the piece, he knocked on wood. He knew that to say something like that was to tempt fate. And it proved to be all the temptation, all the provocation fate needed. Because no sooner did he say that than he had the catastrophic accident that would provide the, quote, material for a new monologue, the one that would be his last. I remember it very clearly. It was the summer of 2001, a bright June Sunday morning. We were in our home in upstate New York, on the farm where our friendship with Spalding began, where he had lived with Howie and me and our two sons in our little guest house for two summers in the early 1980s. Spalding had first driven up on a cold winter afternoon in 1982 because he was looking for a cottage to rent in the country. Often during those months, we would see him walking around the property and mumbling into a tape recorder on which he experimented with practice drafts of the narratives that would go into his monologues. And by the end of that summer, we had become close friends, as it would turn out, for life. On that summer morning in 2001, I checked my email and found a message from a mutual friend, April Gornick, saying that Spalding and Kathy had been involved in a serious auto accident in Ireland. Spalding was gravely injured. He was in the hospital. I immediately called another friend, Robbie Stein, who had the phone number of Spalding's hospital room in Ireland. I phoned, and Spalding answered. There is a very particular, very specific kind of relief we feel when we have been deeply worried about someone we love, and then we see the person or hear the person's voice and realize that person is still alive and with us, still in the world. I realized that something awful had happened, but when I heard Spalding's voice, familiar, laconic, with that unmistakable New England accent he never lost, what I felt was joy, pure joy. I'd been in terror, and the terror instantly melted away. I remember it very clearly. I was sitting outside on the patio on the vintage pink couch that is in fact something like a cross between a sofa and a porch swing. I rocked myself for comfort as I talked to Spalding, and then I no longer needed the comfort of rocking because comfort was streaming through the phone line across the ocean from a hospital room in Ireland to a sunny patio in upstate New York. It was instantly obvious that whatever had happened to Spalding hadn't in the least affected his sense of humor.
In Island Beneath the Sea, master storyteller Isabel Allende spins a tale of a mulatto woman, Tete, a slave and concubine determined to take control of her own destiny. Tete's childhood is marked by brutality and fear, but she finds solace in the traditional rhythms of African drums and the voodoo she discovers through her fellow slaves. When 20-year-old Toulouse Valmoral arrives on the island in 1770, he soon discovers running a plantation is neither glamorous nor easy. Against the backdrop of sugarcane fields, the lives of Tete and Valmoral grow intertwined. The pair flee the island at the outbreak of a bloody revolution and seek out the decadence and opportunity of New Orleans. There, Tete finally forges a new life, but her connection to Valmoral is deeper than anybody knows and not so easily severed. Spanning four decades, Island Beneath the Sea is the moving story of one woman's determination to find love amid loss, to offer humanity though her own has been so battered, and to forge her own identity in the cruelest of circumstances. The book is read by S. Epatha Merkerson.
I learned to clean the keys with lemon juice, but I could not make music because Madame Delphine forbade us to go near her clavichord. We didn't need it. Honoré could draw music from a cook pot. Anything in his hands had beat, melody, rhythm, and voice. He carried sounds inside his body. He had brought them from Dahomey. My toy was a hollow gourd we made to rattle. Later, he taught me to caress his drums slowly. And from the beginning, when he was still carrying me around in his arms, he took me to dances and voodoo services where he marked the rhythm with his drum, the principal drum, for others to follow. This is how I remember it. Honoré seemed very old to me because his bones had frozen stiff, even though at the time he was no older than I am now. He drank tafia in order to endure the pain of moving, but more than that harsh rum, music was the best remedy. His moans turned to laughter with the sound of the drums. Honoré barely could peel sweet potatoes for the mistress's meal, his hands were so deformed. But playing the drum, he never got tired. And when it came to dancing, no one lifted his knees higher or swung his head with more force or shook his behind with more pleasure. Before I knew how to walk, he had me dance sitting down. And when I could just balance myself on two legs, he invited me to lose myself in the music the way you do in a dream. Dance. Dance, Zarete, the slave who dances is free. While he is dancing, he told me. I have always danced. Part 1. Saint-Domingue, 1770 to 1793. the Spanish illness. Toulouse Valmorin arrived in Saint-Domingue in 1770, the same year the Dauphin of France married the Austrian Archduchess Marie Antoinette. Before traveling to the colony, when still he had no suspicion that his destiny was going to play a trick on him, or that he would end up in cane fields in the Antilles, he had been invited to Versailles to one of the parties in honor of the new Dauphine, a young blonde of 14 who yawned openly in the rigid protocol of the French court. All of that was in the past. Saint-Domingue was another world.
And now for something completely different. Academy Award nominee Samuel L. Jackson rocks a mock bedtime story, Go the Bleep to Sleep. This hilarious tale is a bedtime book for parents who live in the real world, where a few snoozy kitties and cutesy rhymes just don't send a troublesome toddler sailing off to dreamland. California author Adam Mansbach's profane, affectionate, and radically honest verses perfectly capture the familiar and unspoken tribulations of putting your little angel down for the night. You'll laugh out loud and want to share this with other tired parents, but be warned, don't play it for the little ones.
The eagles who soar through the sky are at rest, and the creatures who crawl, run, and creep. I know you're not thirsty. Stop lying. Lie the f*** down, my darling, and sleep. The wind whispers soft through the grass, hon. The field mice, they make not a peep. It's been 38 minutes already. What the f***? Go to sleep. All the kids from daycare are in dreamland. The froggy has made his last leap. No, you can't go to the bathroom. You know where you can go? The f*** to sleep. The owls fly forth from the treetops. Through the air they soar and they sweep. A hot crimson rage fills my heart, love. For real, shut the f*** up and sleep. The cubs and the lions are snoring, wrapped in a big, snuggly heap. How come you can do all this other great shit, but you can't lie the f*** down and sleep? The seeds slumber beneath the earth now, and the crops that the farmers will reap. No more questions. This interview's over. I've got two words for you, kid. Sleep. The tiger reclines in the simmering jungle. The sparrow has silenced her cheep. F*** your stuff bad. I'm not getting you. Close your eyes. Cut the crap. Sleep.
Readers, that last selection was quite a departure from Storyland, right? As you know, here on the Book Report, we like to keep it fresh. Comments? Send me a note via the Reader's Corner on my website, bookreportradio.com. Thanks so much for listening today. We'll share new stories again next week on the Book Report. See you then. Too late.